North Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote that over 10 years ago. We've spent the last few weeks telling you not to expect Israel or the United States to fundamentally change Iran, that they're going to remain Islamist and aggressive, and in that sense, their Islamist regime is going to survive whatever Israel throws at them. We've seen that happen. And another key prediction based on the Bible is that Iran will start moving into Africa. We're going to look at why on today's Trumpet World. Here at the Trumpet, we analyze world news in the light of Bible prophecy. And one core prophecy for understanding Iran and the Middle East is Daniel 11, verse 40, and then onwards. And this tells us that Iran will fight Europe over control of Jerusalem. And it tells us about several key nations that will be allied with Iran in this fight. And you can go back and look at our show a couple of weeks ago if you want to get a more detailed understanding of Daniel chapter 11. But until now, Iran has been mostly focused on Syria and Lebanon and getting to Israel that way. Today, I want to look at Iran's push to Africa. It started, but we're also going to see a whole lot more, and we're about to see a major pivot in this direction. So by looking at this subject now, you can watch Bible prophecy be fulfilled in real time. So to help me look at this, I'm joined today by trumpet writer Ezekiel Malone, making his first appearance on the show. Over the last year or so, Zeke has written a series of articles on various different aspects of Iran in Africa, mostly about Sudan and Somalia, two very chaotic countries in different stages of falling apart or civil war. So Zeke, welcome to the show. Can you start by giving us a bit of an overview of what Iran has been doing in this part of Northeast Africa?
First of all, thank you for having me. Mainly, what Iran is doing right now is it is funding, it's so both of these countries, Sudan and Somalia, are very chaotic. There's always wars going on, basically. And when Iran sees violence in a country, it sees opportunity to start funding a side that it favors more, helping it gain more power in that country with hopes that eventually that side can take over the government, Iran can set up a sphere of influence or even control in that nation. And so that's something we see in both Sudan and Somalia. Sudan right now is in the midst of a civil war that started a few years back.
So we've got Sudan and South Sudan, I guess. They've split already, and then they're continuing.
Well, South Sudan isn't really involved in this current war. There are times when it comes up into the news, but that's not really important for the purposes right now. So yeah, Iran often works to take advantage of chaos in countries that it sees potential for power in. And so in Sudan, we see this. Since 2023, Sudan has been in a civil war between the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, and the Sudanese Armed Forces, or the SAF. And for a long time, the RSF was pummeling the SAF. The SAF couldn't find a victory for months, it seemed. And then Iran came in, restored relations with the Sudanese Armed Forces, and after a while, the SAF started winning, and they haven't really started losing ever since. So Iran is really working to ensnare Sudan in its power by not only by funding the SAF, and also there are reports that it's funding radical Islamist groups similar to Hamas or something in Sudan called the Khizan. So it's working in those ways. And then in Somalia, the same thing is happening. Somalia has been at war with a terrorist group called Al-Shabaab since 2006. And Al-Shabaab, it's affiliated with Al-Qaeda and stuff like that, but more significantly, it's affiliated with the Houthis in Yemen. And the Houthis have been training Al-Shabaab soldiers, giving weapons to Al-Shabaab, doing all of this. And this year, Al-Shabaab began an incredibly successful offensive against the Somali government. And so through the Houthis, it seems Iran is able to take advantage of this situation.
So this does seem to replicate the pattern that we've seen elsewhere from Iran. I mean, Syria, obviously very divided. They worked with one faction. That faction has now lost out, but they were able to use that. Lebanon, even more so, divided, they gain power by backing the Shiite faction. So maybe we start by looking at Sudan. What's the root of the disagreement there? Is it simply rival generals and rival kind of teams, but nothing more ideological than that, and one side kind of became desperate enough to go to Iran? Or are we looking at something more like Lebanon, where there's kind of an ideological affinity with Iran, with one of the sides?
I would say with Sudan, it's more just rival generals going at it, though there is more of an ideological affinity between the SAF and Iran than there would be between the RSF and Iran. It definitely, the SAF is much more willing to, they don't openly ally with the Islamist groups in Sudan, but they are more ideologically radical than the RSF would be.
And the SAF, they're closer to the previous Sudanese strongman, Omar al-Bashir, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So basically what happened was Bashir ruled Sudan for, I think, around 30 years. He was a ruthless dictator. And so he had his army, which was called the Sudanese Armed Forces, as we know them today. But he also wanted a private personal defense group, basically. And so he went to a bunch of radical groups in Sudan's west, called the Janjaweed, and he sort of combined them and made this personal security force, which eventually became the Rapid Support Forces. When protests broke out in, I believe, 2019 to overthrow Bashir, the SAF and RSF, they were teammates at the time. They saw what was coming, so they were the ones who eventually toppled him, and they kind of jointly ruled Sudan for the longest time until the SAF's leader, Burhan looked to bring the RSF into the SAF, and so the RSF's leader, Hemeti, as he's known, said absolutely not. He attacked Burhan's fortress where he lived, and then war broke out throughout the country.
And I think the Janjaweed, at least for those of us who grew up in Europe, is probably a term, the Janjaweed militia, very familiar to us from our nightly newspaper, going back probably a couple of decades now, that they were a particularly brutal group. And I remember we saw a lot about those in the news. And so they're the RSF. And then really for both sides, Omar al-Bashir, especially in the early 90s, was very close to Iran. Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps had set up camps. They kind of even trained the the Sudanese army. And Sudan was a key stopping point on the road for weapons smuggling to Hamas in Gaza, but then also was kind of this stopping point for weapons from Iran to spread throughout all of North Africa. And, Omar al-Bashir learned some lessons about that puts you at risk of strikes from Israel, and I think kind of distanced himself a little bit from Iran as time went on, and Europe opened up their pocketbooks as well to try and win him over. But there's a lot of people, my point is just there's a lot of people there that are used to working with Iran, that have worked with the IRGC potentially for decades, and there's a lot of scope for Iran to build on things there. Then Somalia, I think you kind of outlined the situation pretty clearly earlier there, where it's basically the terrorist group. I guess in a lot of ways, it's just Somalia is just a failed state. It's kind of hard to even paint clear sides. There is a terrorist group, and everything else is just kind of a mess. I mean, can you improve on that at all?
Yeah, Somalia is one of, in all the ways we have to define a failed state, Somalia is basically at the top of the list. It's one of the most corrupt countries on earth. The federal government has basically no power. You look at Somalia on a map, you're like, oh, okay, this is all of Somalia. But if you look at what the government actually controls, it's much smaller. There's a portion in the north called Somaliland, which is declared independence. It basically acts autonomously from the government. Right next to it, there's a region called Puntland. I believe Puntland just declared independence as well from the government. Somali government has no control over there. And to its south is a region called Jubaland, which I don't think has declared independence, but basically it kind of is its own state. And so the Somali government only really has control over the middle portion of the country. And even then, it's its ability to control its own people and offer any services is very minimal.
And this is what allowed Somalia to be kind of this pirate haven that, again, I think maybe 10 years ago, that was one of the big national stories, all of these pirate groups operating out of Somalia, the international missions to patrol the waters around there. I think before we move on and maybe get too bogged down on the details of geopolitics, I mean, I think it's worth pausing and maybe you can just give us a picture of the human cost here, because I think this is something that gets overlooked all the time in Africa. Like, there are a lot of people dying in these countries that tend not to make our news. And I mean, maybe we could even do a better job here, I think, with Trumpet World, highlighting some of these conflicts where I just remember when we were first started out with our radio show, KPCG-FM, and we were putting together our own news bulletins, and we were just much more involved in getting hundreds of pieces of news story. I mean, we still collate a lot of news, but this was much more, say, breaking news rather than news analysis. And you would get like two people die in floods in America, and that would be the number one story. And then there would be like 300 people die in a landslide in India, or even thousands in these places. And like Mogadishu in Somaliland, it was every few days you would have a major suicide bombing that would kill dozens of people. But because it's not a place that we go on holiday, it's not a place that people in the West tend to have relatives from, like, it's not something that resonates with us emotionally, so we just don't talk about it. There is a lot of real tragedy going on in these places.
Yeah. I mean, in both of those countries are prime examples of probably like last year, I wrote an article about how the media tries, like, takes every opportunity that it can to portray Israel as this terrible state, and it'll overlook a lot of facts. Basically, for the introduction, I just started saying, like, there's war in the Middle East, these are the numbers of this war, basically. And it sounded like, if you were listening to most outlets, it was talking about Israel and Palestine. But I was actually talking about Sudan, which Sudan has had, I believe, like, many more people displaced, many more people killed, and yet, how often do you hear, I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but how often do you hear about all those people dying in Sudan or in Somalia? Whereas Israel, which is basically a next door neighbor to Sudan, you hear about those numbers all of the time. So yeah, these are real people. The amount of just displacement in Sudan specifically is staggering, because the RSF, one thing it does is it funds recruitment by allowing soldiers to loot anything that they take. And it's made them extremely hated. Actually, a few days ago, Hamedi came out in a public address and said, we have to stop this because the Sudanese people hate us and they're never going to accept our rule. But you have that. For the longest time, you basically had, so the capital of Sudan is Khartoum. And for most of this war, it was kind of split in half, essentially, between the RSF control and the SAF control. And though probably the Berlin split isn't like a super fair analogy, it is kind of a way to think about it. Like, in the RSF controlled areas, everyone was miserable. They would just, like, it was awful all the time, lost awful. The SAF side wasn't much better, but it was still preferable to the people. So when the SAF, like, liberated the entire city, there were, like, shouts for joy throughout, not just the city, but everywhere, just like these people are no longer suffering. And in Somalia, the same things happen. Basically, Al-Shabaab has done a great job conquering territory this year and essentially surrounding Mogadishu, the capital. The problem with that is that they would love to storm Mogadishu and take over the government, but they don't have the strength to have a full frontal assault right now. They would spend too many resources and probably lose, not only lose the attack, but probably lose territory as a result of that. And so right now, they're just kind of waiting, cutting Mogadishu off, and they're just increasing the amount of terrorist attacks in the city. They're just trying to sow as much chaos as possible. And some are speculating they're hoping that there'll be like a stir in the city, an uprising, just chaos that they can then take advantage of, where normally they wouldn't have the strength to go in, but because there are all these terrorist attacks constantly, the people get so there's so much unrest there, they do something, and then they can take advantage of that and conquer Somalia.
And a lot of those tactics have a lot of collateral damage. And that's, I was just looking up a few statistics there, and it's, and another part of the reason I think we don't hear as much about it is you have to be a very brave journalist to go to Khartoum or Mogadishu, whereas, you can be much less brave to go to Tel Aviv. And so you just don't get people there. But also, because of that, then it's actually quite hard to give accurate numbers. So this is from February 2025, so earlier this year, and they were trying to guesstimate how many people have been killed in the fighting with Sudan, and the numbers they came up with range from anywhere from 20,000 to 150,000. Like, that's a pretty huge range. So very hard to calculate. I mean, when you look at Somalia, the number of deaths, say, directly caused by Al-Shabaab seems like are in the hundreds every year, which is bad. But the other side of Africa, Nigeria, Cameroon, some of those other places are probably much worse when it comes to terrorist deaths. But then in both of these, like, famine and disease always follow in the wake of war. And maybe not in the way that the West has experienced war over the last few decades. I don't recall there being much famine, say, after the Iraq War or something like that, where it's kind of this short, sharp shock and awe campaign and then a long insurgency, but still we try to keep everybody fed. But the numbers of dead from famine and disease in some of these areas are just absolutely astonishing. So, I mean, Somalia is the least of them. They estimate that between 2022 and 2024, there were 71,000 excess deaths, which, if you remember back to COVID, that's a slightly controversial. That's kind of trying to statistically estimate how many people have died compared to what the death rate would have been without some of these famines, but still a large number. But then you get into Somalia and, you're starting to talk about potentially 500,000 children since the Sudanese civil war started in 2023. 500,000 children dying of famine. And again, these numbers are very inaccurate, huge, huge error bars. But, civil war leading to famine, and there are environmental issues in there as well, and millions dying. There is a shocking humanitarian toll to what is happening here.
I would think also, like, part of the reason why it's not being reported is just because these things feel so far away. Like, why do Sudan and Somalia matter to your average American who just is living his life? And a lot of that is due to, I mean, you've talked about reporters not being brave enough to go into these countries, but reporters should still be able to see the threat here of that if Iran is coming into these regions. They're both near the Red Sea. I mean, Yemen, I mean, yeah, who cares about the, like, why would American care about the civil war in Yemen?
Then, and that's something that's got a horrendous death toll too.
Yes. Yeah. But then the Red Sea shipping starts getting obstructed, and then all of a sudden Europe's suffering, America's suffering as well. And it's just, if a journalist doesn't get to the real story here, they don't see that Iran is the one doing all this and that the threat is Iran getting a chokehold on the Red Sea, then they're not really going to see a reason to report it besides this is happening and this is sad.
I like that. The geopolitics of it, the ramifications of, they're not a distraction from the death toll. They are part of the way that we publicize the death toll, and people understand how it impacts them. Talking about some of that then, I think one of the things about a lot of these conflicts is they do then very quickly draw in other powers, and that provides Iran then a host of opportunities. Ethiopia, one of the big ones here, because earlier in the year they recognized Somaliland's independence, because that then gave them an opportunity to build a port. But they've had their own civil war, they've had their own conflicts even with Eritrea breaking off, and going back decades, they've been landlocked, they've been wanting to get back to having a port again. So there's an opportunity there. They're also kind of have to be involved with what goes on in Sudan. Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, they're all linked from being dependent on the Nile. And water politics on the Nile gets very heated very quickly, because if one country starts taking more water from the Nile, you start getting famines in other countries. And where Egypt has a foreign currency kind of crisis and struggles to gain the cash to gain bread to feed its poor, and Sudan is already suffering a famine, like, these become matters of life and death very quickly. So from Iran's perspective, though, this is another opportunity. This is an opportunity for them to get a wedge in, establish themselves in one country, but then also these ties can allow them to kind of maybe even domino into other countries in the region.
Yeah. Yeah, if Iran can get control of the Nile, it basically has control of Egypt at that point. There's not much Egypt can do. I mean, Egypt's at the point where Ethiopia has been creating this dam that's been blocking the Nile from reaching Egypt, and it's been hurting Egypt. Thankfully, Egypt hasn't had too terrible of a drought since they started filling up the reservoir, but it has hurt them. And I mean, Egypt has a pretty significant air force. And I mean, even I think President Trump said in his first term, like, Egypt's going to have to blow up that dam eventually. So yeah, the Nile River is a very touchy subject for Egypt. I mean, specifically with Ethiopia, Egypt gets, I think, 60% of its Nile water from Ethiopia. All of the Nile then goes up through Sudan. Sudan even has more power over Egypt's Nile than Ethiopia does. So yeah, a lot could happen here with Egypt, which Egypt is interesting in this because it has to play a very fine line. You talked about other regional powers coming in. Egypt more ideologically aligns with the SAF, but Egypt would not really, its economy would collapse without the United Arab Emirates. The United Arab Emirates has been bailing Egypt out over and over and over again. Egypt has a terrible economy, but the Gulf states are keeping it afloat, basically. The UAE is the RSF's top supporter, basically, in the world. So Egypt wants to help the SAF, but it also can't make the UAE angry, else it's going to lose its thing. So it's like, yeah, you look at Sudan and you think, okay, why does this matter to me? And then you like zoom out and you're like, well, there are a bunch of pieces at play here. And this is like Sudan, it's a very mineral rich country. Lots of gold there, lots of other resources, and it's on the Red Sea, has two major Red Sea ports. Then it has the Nile, connects it to Egypt, connects it to the Middle East. And it's just, yeah, I wish this was a lot more reported on, because Sudan is a much more important region than you might think, just being like, oh, that's some faraway African country.
And on this point of kind of things being interconnected, you start to head further west in Africa, and really, you know, this is, to use a cliche, it's a tinderbox about to explode. Like, the opportunity is so perfect for Iran to continue to move all across Africa, where you have chaos in country after country. You've got the Central African Republic kind of in civil war. You've got Chad with a lot of violence. You've got Niger with a coup. And there's so many countries, Mali with a coup, and you've got kind of a military junta in Mali. And this, I think, brings to one of the other things that you've written on over the last few months. And that is, one commonality between these countries was Russia and Russia's Wagner Group. And they were kind of like back a coup for hire. If you want to, I mean, it's a great proposition for any wannabe tin pot African dictator, because you can get the Wagner Group to come in, help you launch your coup against usually a pretty inefficient, disorganized military, and then pay them back with the spoils that you win after carrying out the coup. And so it's lucrative for Russia, it's lucrative for these guys, leads to all these coups across North Africa. Then Wagner falls apart, and you have the kind of the rebellion there, where Prigozhin, I'll take a stab at his name, tries to, you know, takes a lunge at Putin, and he's eventually bumped off. Syria as well is kind of this key linchpoint distribution hub for Russia to send arms throughout the area. Libya is another one where Russia is strongly backing one faction. And then as the war in Ukraine kind of consumes more and more of Russia's attention, it's like they've caused all of this chaos. They're not completely gone from the scene, but they don't have the influence there that they did. And so you've got more open doors now for Iran to continue to expand across Africa.
Especially because Russia's in control of that empire, basically ranging from Mali to Sudan. The fact that, so basically, yeah, Syria was very important for Russia's African empire. Basically, when Bashar al-Assad was in power and was helping out Russia, Russia could land planes there as a little stopping point before flying to Africa, so they didn't have to use as much fuel. Syria was Moscow's launch pad into Africa. Now Syria is gone. And so Russia can still make it to Africa through Libya, but it has to fly through Turkish airspace, basically, to make it efficiently.
And they're on opposite sides.
Exactly. So if Turkey basically says, no, you're done, Russia can't do much. And I mean, we've seen this. I don't know if this is like exactly connected, but the Wagner Group just moved out of Mali. Now, there was a lot of, like, the Wagner Group was losing incredibly, and Russia decided to cut its losses and leave. And the Africa Corps, which is another Russia-backed group, is still in Mali. But I would expect that over time, because of Syria's loss, you're going to see Russia's grip loosening on Africa, which is more significant because Russia and Iran are friends. Because Iran, especially if it starts sending up spheres of influence in Somalia and Sudan, can reach those countries. So I don't know if this will happen. I could see a possibility where Russia needs to focus on Ukraine, needs to focus on Europe, and it can't really, like, trying to keep its African empire is hurting more than it's gaining. And Russia kind of just hands over the keys to Iran and is like, here you go, have at it. And that would, because not only is Iran moving into Africa, not only is there opportunity here because of this chaos, I would say Iran doesn't really have any other choice right now. Iran's not going to set up a sphere of influence in, like, Bhutan or somewhere in Asia. It's not going to do anything in Europe. The Middle East is a closed door for it right now. Africa really seems to be its only option of survival right now. And with this recent Israeli attack, Iran now knows more than ever, like, we need friends fast. Because if Israel did this attack when Hamas and Hezbollah were still alive and Syria was still on Iran's side, that would have been a completely different situation. Iran may have very well had the absolute upper hand in that war, even with Israel's Western weapons and the like. Just Iran would have had friends in that scenario. There would have been likely terrorist boots on the ground in Israel, invading from all sides, helping keep Iran's nuclear program alive. Then Iran loses Hamas, essentially, loses Hezbollah, essentially, and loses Syria. It's alone, and then it can basically do nothing against Israel. It was completely caught off guard, and it had no one to help it. Russia and China basically abandoned it. I even saw some, I think, Iranian news agencies, like, calling out Moscow and Beijing, like, where were you? They just signed this defense pact with Russia this year, and Russia kind of is like, well, we have to focus on Ukraine. And so not only does Iran have opportunity in Africa, I would argue that it really has no other choice but to move into Africa right now.
I think the other part of that opportunity that's worth touching on is kind of the collapse of Francophone Africa. This, I think, is a pretty big underreported story of the last 3 or 4 years, where of all the former colonial powers, France has somehow, I think, gotten away with having the strongest links to its former colonies. Even economically, a lot of them were tied they use their local versions of the francs, the franc, but it's kind of tied to the French central bank. They've even kind of backed different factions in governments. They've got a whole lot of military bases. They were backing sides in these coups. But a lot of these coups that Wagner Group were involved on, one of the things that they built on was anti-French sentiment. And a lot of them were overtly anti-French coups. And at the same time, France is being squeezed economically. their government is falling apart. They're kind of stuck perennially in this trying to deal with their pensions. Nobody wants to cut the pensions, but they can't afford to keep pensions where they are. Like they just don't have the money to deal with all of this. So they've done things, but it's generally been ineffective. And so this stabilizing influence that was once there is gone. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with President Trump's America as well. Like, America has quite a strong footprint in a lot of places in North Africa. George W. Bush, I think that was one of his kind of unsung influences on the world. I won't call it achievement because there's disagreements as to whether it's a good or bad thing, but he really did up America's presence across a lot of North Africa. That's kind of ebbed and flowed, and it's definitely something you could see President Trump continuing to draw down. So these stabilizing influence also are kind of disappearing. Mm-hmm. It really is quite a fertile region.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, France recently was essentially kicked out of Chad and Senegal. I think both of those countries were saying, we don't really want another country coming in and setting up their sphere of influence here. I don't really know if Chad or Senegal have the ability to stop that from happening. But another thing in this is the United States, it was reported a bit ago, it's considering eliminating its Africa command. I mean, President Trump has more of an isolationist mindset, and he's kind of fallen into that mindset of like, why do I care about Africa to an extent? And that's in Somalia especially, this is a big thing, because basically Al-Shabaab was very powerful for a long time, and then in 2022 the Somali government was actually able to beat it back. But they were only able to do this because this alliance got together of African Union nations, Turkey, the United States, and a few other countries, and they beat Al-Shabaab back. The United States still conducts airstrikes on Somalia from time to time now, but basically the United Nations has to keep renewing its force it has in Somalia to kind of keep Al-Shabaab down every few years. And this most recent time, the United States didn't support it. There are concerns not only over financial issues, but also over humanitarian atrocities like committed by peacekeeping groups in the country, and people don't really want to be associated with that. And so if this like the U.S. not supporting it now wasn't the end of the peacekeeping mission to Somalia, but if this continues, analysts are saying it might get rid of this force to a great enough extent to where Al-Shabaab can take over Somalia, or at least have a lot more power.
And then I think the other place that's just worth, for completeness, touching on that is a tinderbox that may be too far from Iran for them to take too much advantage of, is the Congo. Democratic mm-hmm. Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Uganda. Like, there, you're starting to get outside of the Islamic world. They don't have as much in terms of fellow religionists to draw on there, whereas a lot of these other countries, say Ethiopia is not majority Muslim, but there's a very strong, it's about a third Muslim, kind of Nigeria, again, split between Christian and Islamic. But there's Shiite groups in Nigeria that Iran has very close links to. You get into the Congo and it's more Christian. It's not really a religious conflict. But they did develop quite close ties with Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, a Ugandan militant and warlord. Not because of any ideological compatibility, but because if you're a warlord trying to take control of gold mines and Iran comes along and offers you weapons, people say yes. This is very much in the news right now because you have the M23 rebel group and there's been a peace deal and there's a lot of talk of, is it going to hold? Is it going to fall apart? I mean, have you seen much in the way of Iran kind of moving in that direction?
No, because not one. The Congolese war right now is different, because when we think of war, we think like Russia against Ukraine, Israel against Iran, RSF against the SAF. The Congolese war is absolutely not that. Basically, it's all these different militias in the east of the Congo fighting against each other. The the DRC is a huge country, so much territory for one government to try to conquer. So you've got all these different militias, then you've got like Rwanda in there. Everyone kind of just assumes this war is about minerals. That is a part of it, but that, I mean, it's only a part of it. Like, Rwanda kind of sees, I believe, the Eastern Congo as part of its sphere of influence. So it kind of sees itself like it has a right to be there. So when it comes to Iran, there are just so many moving parts there, and there's not really like one side that's like, yes, this side's going to win, we should fund them, because I don't really know if any side would really give its allegiance to Iran. Even the government is kind of acting like all of the militias in this war. And the government actually is kind of cozying up to the US in this, because the Congolese government went to President Trump and was like, hey, if you help us, we'll give you a bunch of our amazing minerals, which President Trump loves that deal, obviously. And it seems, I believe that that's going to go through unless something's happened that I'm not aware of there. But yeah, in the Congo, like, as you said, the religion, the fact that the U.S. might be stepping in to an extent, and the fact that there are just so many moving parts. There's not like one militia Iran could be like, okay, we're gonna fund this and it's gonna win the war, because it's a much more complicated conflict than others that get more press coverage.
That makes sense. I think that the last I read about Iran being involved there was from some research from the Conflict Arms Research Institute, I think is the name, and they were tracing through Iranian small arms and how much they popped up in conflicts like the Congo. But they also concluded a lot of that is just because there's sanctions on Iranian weapons. So they, you know, they're not going to be exhibiting their weapons at the Paris Air Show or something like that. They're going to sell their weapons, they've got to sell it to some of these unsavory groups. Like, they're the only people that are going to be buying them. So that leads to that link up. But also, you're right, I think that this is, the Congo conflict is not really in our newspapers very much. And again, over the last 30 years, it's about 6 million dead. Millions more refugees. It's a big conflict that doesn't make it into the news very much. But because of those minerals, I think it is one that China is quite closely watching. The United States is quite closely watching. So this does seem maybe a bridge too far for Iran at the moment. All right, so that's an overview of the region as it stands now. Clearly, we're expecting Iran to move into North Africa. What does the Bible have to say about what is coming next for this region?
So the trumpet for its entire history basically has been watching Africa closely, saying Iran's eventually going to move in. I remember there was a report a few months ago I wrote about, basically talking about how Iran's using the Houthis to move into Africa. They're calling it Iran's Axis of Resistance 2.0. And this article kind of made it sound like this was they said this was unexpected. And I was able to be like, well, the trumpet's actually been watching this for a long time, because Daniel 11, verses 40 through 43, talk about this coming clash between the King of the North, which is a European power about to rise, and the King of the South, which is radical Islam led by Iran. And in verses 42 and 43, I believe, it mentions Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia as being destroyed along with the King of the South. So from this, we're able to know that Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia are not only going to be on Iran's side, we can also use this to speculate that countries like Eritrea, Djibouti, and maybe even Somalia will also join with the King of the South. And we don't know where Sudan's going to line up, but it would theoretically make sense, though we don't know, that if both countries on either side of the Nile were King of the South, Sudan would be as well. It's also interesting to think of Sudan this way because Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has mentioned that in that passage, Egypt is mentioned twice, while Libya and Ethiopia are only mentioned once, showing that Egypt is going to be the power to bring Libya and Ethiopia to Iran's side. And so if Egypt's going to bring Ethiopia to Iran's side, it would be physically hard to see how Sudan wouldn't get enthralled in that. Though there is a possibility, maybe the RSF's more aligned with Europe, maybe it comes through, pulls out a victory, has secure power there, aligns with Europe against Iran. Maybe the Sudanese people revolt against both parties and invite Europe in to set up their own government, and Europe takes advantage of that.
And there's precedent for that. Europe paid Omar al-Bashir billions, or at least millions, to set up a concentration camp, basically for migrants in Africa traveling north. And here was somebody who was literally a convicted war criminal at The Hague, and they were quite happy to give him money and stabilize his regime if it meant not having weapons, not having migrants come to them, which, as I never tired of pointing out at the time, it was the same European leaders during President Trump's first term that sneered at Donald Trump and called him an evil person for building a wall with Mexico while they were literally paying a wanted war criminal to put migrants in concentration camps. But the point is, they've done those kind of deals before.
And Europe doesn't want Iran to get this stranglehold on the Red Sea. Like, Europe is watching this closely. My first big article on Sudan that came out over a year ago, I found this report called The EU's Pact with the Devil. And it was by these two investigative journalists actually sort of found out that the European Union was, in a way, silently supporting the RSF, because the RSF, it's used them to stop immigrants from going to Libya and then to Europe. They prefer the RSF, it's less radical, they have more of an affinity to it. And so, like, prophetically, in an article entitled Watch Algeria, Mr. Gerald Fleury talked about how there's going to be these, Iran and Europe are going to clash over Africa, basically. And I was able to use that investigative journalist piece to show that, like, it might not be an open battle between Europe and Iran and Sudan right now, but there are, it seems there are money trails from both sides coming in. So to say that Sudan will eventually align with Europe and not with Iran isn't an insane assumption necessarily. We just don't know right now.
But that European connection is important to emphasize. I think first I just wanted to pick up on that point you made about Egypt being the linchpin. You referenced this earlier, but this is what Mr. Fleury wrote in The King of the South. He says, one more detail from this prophecy that's worth noticing. The emphasis in Daniel 11, 42 and 43 is on Egypt. Then we have Libya and Ethiopia. This shows that Egypt is the big conquest. It is the real power behind Libya and Ethiopia, which suggests that it is going to have a heavy hand in swinging those two nations into the Iranian camp. We need to understand the enormous impact that Egypt working with Iran will have in the Middle East and even globally. This Iran-Egypt axis will change the game in the Middle East, particularly in Libya and Ethiopia. This means we can expect Egypt, with Iran's help, to lead Libya and Ethiopia into the Iranian camp. And he quotes Barnes' notes as well, that analyzes the text here and says a conquest of Egypt was almost in itself a conquest of Libya and the Ethiopians. And Mr. Fleury says that's exactly right. The real powerhouse here is Egypt. And you look at these countries, and that absolutely makes sense. I mean, you kind of go back to the point that we made at the beginning, that Iran tends to work with a lot of these fractured states, and that Sudan is a fractured state, Somalia, Ethiopia. Like, these are all countries where you've got different religions, sometimes different tribes. Libya's like this as well, kind of forced to live in one country by the way the borders are drawn on the modern maps. But they don't have a history of hundreds of years of commonality in the same way the French or the Italians have that. There is no kind of uniting love of one nation. There is no sense that, okay, you and me, we may disagree on some big things, but fundamentally we're both Libyan or Sudanese, and that is more important than what divides us. Like, that's just not there. Their nations are artificial constructs that they don't really feel any sense of loyalty to. That makes them really weak. And Egypt is the one big exception to that, where there has been Egypt for almost as long as there has been any. I think you can argue that Egypt is perhaps the oldest nation state on the planet, or close to that. So there's a cohesiveness, a power. I mean, they've got a population much larger than a lot of these other countries as well. They are very clearly kind of a cornerstone of stability. And if they get brought into the Iranian camp, that is an earthquake for the entire region.
And Egypt has been very interesting since the 12-day war began. It's looking at this, like, when Iran's first started getting pummeled, it it became harder to see how Egypt would end up on Iran's side, because Iran has to be in the position where Egypt wants to be on Iran's side, theoretically. And it just seemed like Iran looks so weak right now. It's going to take a while for it to rebuild, for Egypt to want to be on its side. Egypt has been cozying up to Iran more since that war started, which is incredibly interesting, because looking at the scenario physically, that doesn't seem like a very good move, and we don't really know how things are going to work out. But it is significant that even, like, Sisi, who isn't a radical Islamist, he's not from the Muslim Brotherhood, he's willing to cozy up to Iran even as it's weak, alone, and being pummeled by Israel.
Yeah, we did a whole show about a year ago, maybe a little less than that. Haider and I talked about Egypt, and so if you want to see more, that was one of our most popular shows of 2024. You could go back and find that. I mean, there's a lot of links and just interesting overlaps between Egypt and Iran. Hassan al-Banna is one of the kind of the founding figures of modern political Islam and even modern Islamic terror. He's the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. He was an Egyptian school teacher. What he started had a lot of influence on political Islam in Iran, even though they're one Sunni and the other Shiite. Then when political Islam took over Iran, Egypt offered to host the Shah of Iran. You then had later, almost certainly with Iranian backing, the Muslim Brotherhood assassinate the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat, and Iran really celebrated that. So, I mean, there's influences, there's bad blood. It's remarkable to see that bad blood being overcome now, but there's a lot of ties between the two.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of it, Egypt has historically has been pretty disloyal to whoever it's affiliated with. It was with the Soviet Union for a while, then the Soviet Union started falling, it moved over to America. It's there today, but perhaps with President Trump's isolationist mindset, they're starting to see, okay, the U.S. is moving out. We need to find someone else. And an important factor concerning Egypt is that Egypt feels very vulnerable, because Egypt has a huge population, but pretty much less than 3% of its land is inhabitable. So everyone is just grouped together in the Nile region, especially the Nile Delta. And the Nile Delta is very vulnerable to attack if you don't have a strong navy. Egypt does not have a strong navy, but one thing that the Ukraine war and similar things is proving is that if you have a good drone program, you can put up at least somewhat of a fight against a navy. And Iran is known for exporting drones everywhere. They're actually moving their program into Africa as much as they can. So that's something that would make sense from an Egyptian perspective. It's like, okay, America's leaving. We don't have the protection we might once have. The Gulf states are kind of, it seems, getting annoyed at just bailing out Egypt as it spends all this money on these
stupid things,
stupid projects.
A new capital city when mm-hmm. you're struggling to feed your own people. Yeah.
And it says Egypt needs a friend, especially because Turkey's navy is very scary to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And they know they're vulnerable. The Nile Delta is very vulnerable, and they need, if not a strong navy, they need some sort of alternative to help defend that northern flank.
And then from Iran's perspective, you know, we've got to remember their focus on Jerusalem and how, you know, the overseas branch of that's in charge of exporting the revolutionary, well, the Iranian revolution, is the Al-Quds force, the Jerusalem force. They're really focused on conquering Jerusalem, and that is as a tool as well to unite the Arab world behind them. Well, they were working with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and that did put them pretty close to Jerusalem on Israel's northern border, and Hamas in Gaza gave them an opportunity, an opening to strike there. They've lost that. They've been severely set back. They're going to be looking for more opportunities in the area. They'll be looking at Jordan. They'll be looking at Fatah, and they'll be looking at the West Bank, but they will also be looking at Egypt. Mm-hmm. And for Israel, like, everything that they've done over the last couple of years since October 7th has been founded on this kind of assumption that they live in the world where the southern border is secure and they don't need to worry about the Sinai. Unlike the 70s and the 60s, and where they had to, their army could potentially be split in multiple directions. Now, you know, they, if they're going to go and deal with Hezbollah, they can do that, and they don't need to leave half their forces in the south to protect against Egypt. One of the fundamental assumptions of Israeli security will go out the window if Iran can swing Egypt behind it. So it's a very tempting prize for Iran as well.
And I would say Iran could get in there somewhat easily. I mean, you mentioned the new capital city that they're building, and a lot of people are speculating that essentially Cairo is a pretty easy city to revolt in because everything's kind of connected on one street. So if a bunch of people block that street, it's harder for the government to function. And so it's easier for governments to fall. I mean, it happened twice in the span of a few years back with the Arab Spring and then whenever Sisi took over. And that's why they say they're building this new capital city. Sisi's government says it, so, oh, we have overpopulation, we need more places for people to live. But it seems like he's just building kind of a military fortress for himself to protect himself, because he knows that with all these factors going around, especially Ethiopia cutting off a lot of its water through the dam it's building, that unemployment is going up, inflation's going up, overpopulation is coming up from the war in Sudan, just bringing migrants up. The ability to like have food is just going down. Not only do you have more people, but Egypt has to buy all of its wheat, essentially, and the top two wheat exporters are Russia and Ukraine. And so they're in a war, they can't do much, and so Egypt is really suffering because of that war. Egypt has, like, I think a year ago or so, I wrote an article basically like, Egypt is kind of an epicenter of prophecy with everything going on in the Middle East. Everything's kind of surrounding it and is just building tensions on Egypt to where it's almost ready to snap. Whether that is Sisi turning to Iran for help or the people rising up, ousting Sisi and setting up a more radical Islamist government, we'll have to see. But I mean, Bible prophecy says Egypt's going to snap, and it's not too difficult to see how that might happen.
So the next thing that is worth talking about from Bible prophecy is this point about Europe getting involved, which obviously you mentioned. You know, Daniel 11 talks about the king of the south pushing at the king of the north, king of the south being radical Islam led by Iran, and the king of the north being this European power that's talked about as the beast power elsewhere in the Bible. It's also a religious power. It's also a power very focused on Jerusalem. And again, we had a show a couple of weeks ago where we took you through in a lot more detail and at a lot slower pace some of those prophecies. And that's why Mr. Flurry has said, you know, they're going to clash in this area. Watch for that. And this is something that when Iran starts moving in and getting even more control over this area, it is going to impact Europe fast. And it's not an accident of geography that this, a lot of North Africa, including Egypt, was part of the Roman Empire, because it's just the Mediterranean connects things. The Mediterranean kind of, it means our sea, the Mare Nostrum. It's Europe's sea. They own it. They are used to sailing and trading over it with complete impunity. I've been surprised that the Houthis have been kind of allowed to take pot shots at shipping for as long as they have going through the Red Sea. But at least there's another way around. And if you start having a similar group to the Houthis taking pot shots on the Mediterranean Sea, and the results, it will have a many orders of magnitude bigger, faster effect. I mean, you'd also be hitting yachts of the super rich, as well as trading goods and even people ferries, things like that. But then also you have civil wars, and if you lack a combination of civil wars and then a lack of regimes that are aligned with Europe that are willing to lock migrants in concentration camps, and Europe has a lot of deals with all the different factions in, say, the Libyan civil war to try and arrest people before they get to the coast. They had it in with Sudan. They have it with a lot of these countries. They have it with Algeria and Tunisia. You start losing that, and you start having more civil wars, and you have a wave of migrants heading towards Europe that makes 2015 look pretty small. And 2015, like, leaders were losing their jobs left, right, and center. The current kind of political crisis and paralysis in Europe, where you have fringe parties gaining 20 to 30% of the vote in country after country and then completely gumming up European politics because no one has a majority, dates back to 2015. You will see governments fall, potentially even revolutions, if you start to have something bigger, you know, 10 times the size of that. So this is something that Europe will also have to respond to very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And especially once Egypt falls, because when Egypt falls to, or I don't know if falls is the right word, whenever Egypt turns to
right.
Iran...
Right, El-Sisi is shifting towards Iran. Yeah, it might not be a regime change.
Whatever happens there, then Iran's got a grip on the Suez and on the Mediterranean now. And what happens then, as Bible prophecy says, Egypt will be the linchpin that brings Ethiopia, but more significantly, Libya. You know, we say Egypt will bring Libya to Iran's side, and that might be kind of confusing because the recognized government of Libya kind of already is on Iran's side, while Egypt isn't. So it's easy to think, well, how does that work? Most of Libya is controlled by an opposition regime not controlled by Iran. It's about half the population still, but it's like vast swaths, like most of Libya isn't under Iran's control. And so there's peace there between the two sides, but they still don't like each other. They still kind of have to focus on each other. And, you know, if Egypt sort of turns to Iran, and that's kind of how Egypt becomes that linchpin for Libya, is it sort of blots out Khalifa Haftar's government in eastern Libya. All of Libya is now this pro-Iran country. Then all of a sudden, Libya's threat to the Mediterranean and Europe is a lot greater because it doesn't have to, it's, Libya's not in this constant struggle. One side's gone, Libya can then focus on something else.
And the other side of this as well is energy, that we haven't even talked about at all yet, mm-hmm. where you've got, in the scenario you're talking about, you close the Suez, well, now you have trouble getting oil from the Middle East. I mean, that's still an issue even with the Houthis, but that steps that up. The Ukraine war means that Europe is buying less and less from Russia, and the Nord Stream pipelines aren't there. Europe gets a lot of resources, a lot of natural gas and a lot of oil from pipelines that come through Libya, through Algeria. There's plans for more. There's plans for a trans-Saharan pipeline that would take oil from or gas or hydrocarbons in some form from Nigeria's fields all the way across the Sahara Desert. Europe would love that, but it's not viable until they've gotten control of the terrorism in that area, because explosive pipelines are very easy to blow up. So there's a lot of reasons for Europe to get involved as this area falls mm-hmm. apart.
And Algeria and even maybe Morocco are interesting. I mean, I don't know if we've written on this too much, but there's been speculation that perhaps Algeria could even fall into the Iranian camp. Morocco's also very Muslim. It's Sunni Muslim, so it might not want to go that way. But should Iran get control of Algeria, theoretically, terrorists from Algeria can start shooting at ships going through Gibraltar, which would then, like, if the Suez is closed and Gibraltar is now being hurt by damage, I mean, Europe is in a terrible position at that point. Not only because Europe gets so much of its oil from Algeria and nations like that, but the two choke points into southern Italy essentially are obstructed.
That's a great point. I mean, that's a really interesting point I hadn't thought about as much, threatening Gibraltar. But even just the scale of traffic coming through the Straits of Gibraltar is considerably bigger than coming through the Suez Canal. I mean, this is kind of on the top of my mind right now because for the next Trumpet print, I just wrote an article talking about Britain giving away the Strait of Gibraltar. But for the Panama Canal, on average, you have one ship going through the Panama Canal every 40 minutes. Suez Canal, one ship every 20 minutes. Strait of Gibraltar, it's a ship every 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's a very busy sea lane, and you can do a lot of... You're looking at least five times the damage if you're just counting quantity of ships to the Suez Canal, and presumably it's a similar number coming through the Bab el-Mandeb that the Houthis are taking shots at the moment. So again, another massive reason for Europe to be drawn in.
Yeah, and it does seem like, I mean, there's been lots of speculation over what this, like the Daniel 11, 40 through... 43 talks about the King of the South pushing at the King of the North, which we've said could revolve around Jerusalem, a push for Jerusalem, which Europe wouldn't accept, or something with oil as well. And it would seem like something like that would be more likely, because we say the King of the South will push, but Germany and the King of the North will start World War III. it might make more sense in that context to say Iran cuts off oil from Europe, and Europe is like, we have to act, and goes and destroys the King of the South, than to say the King of the South starts bombing Europe and sending in troops and all that jazz, and then Europe has to respond. Because at that point, Iran's starting World War III in some ways, unless you don't consider the King of the South, King of the North clash as part of World War III yet. This is honestly why I love watching Africa so much, because a lot of it we just don't know. Like, a lot of prophecies, we know the end result, we don't know how this is going to play out. Africa, there's just a lot more nuance there, and it's incredibly fun to watch just because there's a lot we just don't know.
So there's a lot that we don't know, but we have left you with quite a lot of specific things to watch. You can watch for Egypt. You keep watching for that. Keep watching now that Iran has had this major setback in the 12-day war. Watch for them to make that pivot into Africa. Expect to see more headlines. Expect to see potentially more chaos in Africa, and then expect to see Europe get involved here. And you may well see kind of almost a chess game between Europe and Iran as the two of them. And I think you see this mutedly and behind the scenes already to a certain extent, as they kind of compete for interest or as they compete for influence, before you see the kind of dramatic push and Europe's dramatic strike back. And watch for Europe to be preparing already for that strike back. I mean, that's something else that Mr. Flurry's drawn attention to from Daniel 11. And he's pointed out in verse 40, talks about Europe coming against Iran like a whirlwind. And that whirlwind term absolutely has connotations of ferocity, and it's a brutal attack, but also it's surrounding, a surround attack. They surround the King of the South. They surround Iran and their allies. And that means setting up bases and alliances across North Africa. And you see that being fulfilled already. You see Europe trying to make relationships with various different governments and have arms sales and things like that. And they don't have this prophecy to guide them. So, they're working quite hard, for example, to have arms sales with Egypt and work with them. But anyone that they think that could be on their side against Iran, they're trying to build a relationship with. But I think what I want to leave you with is this is a fantastic opportunity to watch Bible prophecy in action. And this, we did talk about, say, the death toll and the tragedy in a lot of Africa. And maybe another reason that doesn't get reported is it just feels kind of bleak and hopeless, and okay, we're less connected, so it doesn't affect us much, but it also feels like, well, I can't do anything. I can be sad, but how does that help? And so if we just kind of desensitize it and ignore it. But this prophecy shows the solution to that. This is not God's world. Satan is the God of this world. But at the same time, God is ultimately in charge of the universe. Satan and his evil spirits that the Bible and that Jesus Christ talks about a lot, they're only allowed to operate in a way that God allows them to. And he has ultimate control. And he is allowing them to operate, and he's allowing evil only in as far as it goes along with his plan. And he has a plan. He has made prophecies. He's bringing them about. He's more powerful than Satan and the evil. And he is bringing all of this about to bring about a world where mankind learns and turns away, repents of living the way of life that causes evil and suffering, and turns to God and embraces God's law and embraces the way of life that causes good and joy and happiness. And this is, if we go to earlier in the book of Daniel, this passage that we kind of quote a lot in Daniel 4 and verse 17, God humbled the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, and he said, why? Well, that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. Man needs to learn that God rules in the kingdom of men, and that we can only have peace and harmony if we submit to God. And it's leading to a whole world. God rules now despite mankind's rebellion. And he's going to bring all of these events to pass so that it leads to a world that submits to God's law and government. And that's going to lead to the Sahara Desert blossoming like the rose, and to abundant harvests in Sudan, and peace in Somalia, and in these countries that have been at war and fighting each other for decades. And so understanding prophecy and watching what happens next, watching God ruling in the kingdom of men in the weeks and months ahead and seeing it happen exactly the way Daniel 11 played out with absolutely, I'm sure, some twists, some things that we don't expect, a lot of the question marks that we have being filled in. But watching it happen all the way that God said, we're seeing God's power and we're seeing demonstrated that God is intervening in world events and he's going to bring about a wonderful world, ultimately for Iran, once they're corrected and submitting to him, to Europe, to Egypt. You know, Isaiah singles out both Egypt and Germany in Bible prophecy as nations that submit to God and receive incredible blessings for doing so, and then that work in harmony with the descendants of Israel. So this is rapidly leading to a wonderful, wonderful world, and it's really a great opportunity to build your faith in watching these areas that don't get talked about as much and don't get viewed by the mainstream media as all that important. Well, there are opportunities for you to watch the Bible come alive, to build your faith in the Bible, to build your hope in what God says, to realize the power of these words and that they still hold authority over you, over world events, over your life, and really help you value these words and then dig into them to know how to bring your life in harmony with God's plan for you and to have all of those joy, that joy and blessings that God wants to give you. So I think there's a wonderful vision behind watching these events. So thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed this discussion. I think it's been a fascinating look at an area we probably need to keep coming back on, especially now that Iran has kind of had this 12-day war transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for having me.
And we will be back on Friday for our regular Week in Review show. Thank you very much to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. If you have any questions, comments on the show, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. If you want to order any of the material that we've mentioned on this show, and once again, the King of the South is a fantastic resource for you seeing God's power in world events. And you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com, and we'll have a link in the show notes below. So we will be back on Friday. Until then, keep watching your world.